So what do you do if you believe you've been rushed to foreclosure, if relevant facts were not considered? What do you do if you're on your way to foreclosure now? To try to answer these questions, we're joined now by our money coach, Alvin Hall. He's with us from New York. Thanks again, Alvin, for coming in.
I'm very glad to be here, especially to talk about this subject.
Well, you know, it's important to emphasize, as Mr. Madigan just did, that the process varies state by state. In 23 states, foreclosure is a judicial matter, as he told us, you know, where the courts are involved. In mm-hmm. other states, it isn't. So that's about half and half. So the first thing I wanted to ask is, you know, if you're in a state where the courts get involved in foreclosure, what do you do?
You must hire a lawyer. That's really key. And people think, well, how do I go about finding a lawyer? Well, at this time when foreclosures are so widespread, you can basically call the financial regulatory agency or the banking agency in your state and find out which lawyers are involved in that area. Or you can probably go to one of the government websites that also talk about individual states organizations that are helping people. The thing is to network your way into that organization so that you are a part of a larger group, and therefore do not have to absorb all the costs on your own.
One of the things that concerns me is that you see a lot of these ads on the buses these
Absolutely.
Days for these groups and, you know, signs like posted on the side of the road with people saying, I'm going to help you out of foreclosure and things of that sort. And I always wonder, how do you know who's, you know, on the up and up and who is also just part of another scam?
Call the Better Business Bureau and get information about the organization before you write a check. And if somebody is pressuring you for money up front and you don't feel right about this, back away from the organization. But definitely check with the Better Business Bureau. Don't rely upon a friend of yours who says, I know somebody down the street, they're a really good lawyer and they're helping people do this. Forget that. Do your homework before you sign up with the organization. Do not become a victim of another fraud.
And I do have to ask, Alvin, I'm sure a lot of people are saying, look, if I had the money to hire a lawyer, I could pay my mortgage. So how do you handle that quandary?
The lawyer is much more important than paying your mortgage. And if you're on the verge of foreclosure or you are in the process, you need to hold on to your cash just in case everything goes through so that you have money to live on. The lawyer will cost you a small amount of money, especially if they're representing a large number of people in this action. Do not write a big check to a lawyer. Do not.
And what if you're in a non-judicial state, a state where foreclosures are not handled by the courts?
In that case, there are lots of nonprofit organizations that are being set up in the state to help people through the process, to tell you what papers you should file, what actions you should take, what are your exact rights. Find one of those nonprofit organizations, and there's some in every city, and get them to help you through the process.
What might be a clue that you are a person who's been a victim of this kind of conduct?
I think it's all in the attitude of the company you're dealing with. If they are being really hard-nosed, if they don't want to send you documents proving something that you're contesting, if they're constantly threatening you in very subtle ways, it may be the first sign that they are not on solid ground, that they're trying to essentially bulldoze their way through you in order to get you out of your house. Keep asking. Get help. Do not try to do this on your own in that case.
And finally, Alvin, you know, I have to ask this question. I mean,
yes.
We've talked about this as we know, the foreclosure crisis has sort of escalated over the last couple of years. And, you know, it's been an article of faith that lenders don't want to foreclose on people.
That's right.
They don't want to be left with an inventory of homes. If they can work with you, they will. This behavior would seem to indicate that that understanding that people have traditionally had is not true.
It's not
so,
true.
So why would lenders be rushing to foreclose on homeowners who are trying to work something out with them?
First of all, you're not dealing with the lender. You're dealing mostly with the servicing organization. So the lender no longer has the loan on their books, and you're dealing with some amorphous person out there with whom you have no direct contact, who has no investment within your community. When I think of this situation, Michelle, I always think of something I learned in college, which is Plato's analogy of the cave. If you're outside looking in a cave and there's a fire inside and there are people standing around the cave, how do you know that they're real people there? Because you see their shadows reflected on the wall. So I think we've come to believe that when we look inside that cave, which is that bank, we assume there's a real person there with whom we have a connection. Today, that loan has been sold and sold on and sold again. So what you're dealing with is a shadow of a real person. There is no real person who has any interest in your loan or your community. So I think that the financial markets have, in essence, betrayed us.
Wow. Strong words. Alvin Hall is Tell Me More's regular contributor on matters of personal finance and the economy. He joined us from our bureau in New York. And we'd like to hear from you. Tell us your stories. If you are in this situation or you suspect that you may be, we'd like to hear from you. Call us at 202-842-3522. Please remember to leave your name or go to our website. Go to npr.org, click on Programs, then on Tell Me More, and blog it out.
This weekend, the movie The Social Network opened across the country. The film is a fictional account of the creation of Facebook, and it paints a pretty dark portrait of founder Mark Zuckerberg. While the film may not be entirely true, NPR's Laura Seidel checked in with some Silicon Valley entrepreneurs to hear if they thought it rang true.
The critics keep saying that the film doesn't make the founder of Facebook look very good. The Zuckerberg in the film has some petty motivations for starting his company, trying to prove himself to girls and to the establishment at Harvard. But from the perspective of people working in Silicon Valley startups, the Zuckerberg in the film is a role model and a hero.
When people do big things, there are problems along the way.
26-year-old Ash Rust is an engineer at Clout, a company that ranks individual influence on Twitter.
I don't think that any revolution has been completely clean, and this was a communication revolution.
But more importantly to Rust, Zuckerberg is portrayed as a man with a vision.
So I think they did a very good job at capturing the emotions and energy of an early stage startup. People don't sleep, but when they do, they dream of a kingdom. 500 million people, the entire world connected in some way through your product.
The film moves back and forth between the creation of Facebook and the proceedings of two lawsuits against Zuckerberg after the rise of his company. In one of the cases, two twin brothers from Harvard charged Zuckerberg with stealing their idea.
People are very possessive and protective of this one idea they had in the bathroom one day 5 years ago.
That's how it is in the movie, but that's not how it is in the Valley, where people are always throwing around ideas, says Rebecca Huang, an engineer and one of the founders of Unoodle, a company that uses mathematical formulas to predict the success of startups.
We feel for people like Mark, who put in the sweat and the blood and the time and the effort to make it happen.
Zuckerberg definitely comes off as hardworking and obsessed in the film, but there's also a lot of partying, drinking, and drugs. This group of entrepreneurs finds that picture a little bit exaggerated.
There's beer in the fridge.
Yeah, that's a lot of caffeine. Red Bull.
Most of the women in the film are model beautiful, and they are usually partying and having a good old time. That's not quite the real women in Silicon Valley Jim Ying knows. He's with social gaming startup Six Waves.
I definitely thought that the portrayal of women in it was, whatever, it's sensationalistic. It's definitely kind of skewed and stereotyped.
But hey, says Ying, that's Hollywood. Ying thinks if this film was meant to be a morality tale to discourage people from being like Mark Zuckerberg, it's likely to fail the same way that the original 1987 movie Wall Street did. A movie about greed became an inspiration for an entire generation to enter the financial world.
I'd be curious to see if people who are somewhat inclined to start startups see this as this is a cool way to kind of live your life. They might not be kind of pulling out the morals that this is not a cool way to start a business.
But in Wall Street, the main character, Gordon Gekko, declares greed is good. In The Social Network, Zuckerberg becomes a billionaire, but money isn't what drives him. He wants to change the world. That makes him a hero for a generation that sees its revolution in social games, faster video, and mobile computers. And as a nation, we've seen a lot of fallout from people motivated by greed. So the motivations of this generation may seem like an improvement. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
There may be a new way to treat a disease that's been devastating to generations of teenagers, anorexia nervosa. Children often have to be hospitalized to get better. Some even die. In the October issue of the Archives of General Psychiatry, researchers report long-term success for teens who undergo intense family-based treatment. NPR's Patty Naiman explains.
For decades, doctors have been struggling to come up with a really successful way to treat anorexia patients. Now they think they may have one. Psychologist Daniel LaGrange is one of the authors of this new study.
We can much more confidently say that a teenager with anorexia nervosa who is medically stable should, as a first-line treatment, receive family-based treatment.
Family-based treatment turns traditional therapy on its head. In the past, doctors tried to treat the underlying causes of anorexia, and the family was often pushed to the side. But in family-based treatment, the emphasis is on weight gain first, and it's the parents who take the pivotal role.
No one is more available to care for their kids than parents are. No one would put the time aside in the way that parents would, and no one loves their children more than parents do.
LaGrange directs the Eating Disorders Clinic at the University of Chicago Medical Center, one of the study sites where 120 teenagers were divided into two groups. One group received traditional one-on-one therapy. The other received family-based treatment, which was first taught to their parents by experts like LaGrange.
The parents have to be coached that they are making the decisions about how much the teen needs to eat in order to recover. The decisions are theirs, the timing of the meals are theirs, the preparation of the food are theirs, and they put it in front of the patient and say, this is difficult for you, but you have to eat this. I'm going to sit here with you until you can.
No matter how long it takes, parents literally sat with their teenager until all the food was gone for each and every meal and snack. One of the teenagers in the study who received this type of treatment was Rena Rinaldi's 12-year-old daughter.
We would start eating and there would be the usual, I'm not going to have this, there's no way, I'm not, you know, the usual defiance. And then we were as calm as we could be and we would simply say over and over, this is your medicine. We're not leaving. You're going to be safe. It's going to be okay. You're going to get through this. We're going to be here with you. And suddenly, the forks would go to the mouth and it would happen.
As her daughter began to put on weight, the psychological problems associated with anorexia, like depression, anxiety, and isolation, also began to diminish. Until finally, after nearly a year, her daughter was once again healthy.
She actually likes food, and it's great. It's great to have her back, and it's great to be able to watch her grow up.
Over the past few years, an increasing number of doctors and therapists are initiating this type of family treatment. Psychologist Sari Shepherd specializes in eating disorders. She says it makes much more sense to tackle the weight gain first.
If there are underlying issues of anxiety or perfectionism, which is a chronic trait in those that we find with anorexia nervosa, we do address those in psychotherapy, but instead of addressing them first and putting weight restoration on the back burner, we've now flipped the order and we focus primarily on weight restoration. And then the person is strong enough and in a better position to be able to address the underlying issues that exist.
While both individual and family therapy did help most kids in the study get back to normal weight within a year, the teenagers who had family therapy were far more likely to stay healthy. 1 year after treatment, only 10% of them relapsed, compared to 40% of kids who got individual therapy. Patty Namond, NPR News.
Bill Bryson is an author known for exploring far-flung places. He's written about the Australian outback, the Appalachian Trail. He's even written a history of the universe. Now he's found inspiration at his own door. Bill Bryson's new book, called At Home, is a room-by-room history of domestic life. He started the project wondering about his house, an old Victorian parsonage in England.
What if I just treated our own home as a universe in its own right, and I just kind of wandered around it and wrote about the history of that? And my idea was that the book is tied to this specific house, but it's looking at more general history of domesticity everywhere.
And you started the book with the part of the house that we hardly ever think of today. We merely pass through it, the hall.
The hall, yeah. I mean, I'd always wondered a little bit about that. Why, you know, hall is... denotes important spaces in the wider world, you know, Hall of Fame or Carnegie Hall, that kind of thing. And yet in our own homes, it's this dinky room, the most demoted room in the house, because at one time the whole house was the hall. I mean, originally in the Middle Ages, the house was just a single room with perhaps a couple of annex rooms, like a kitchen off of it. But most living was done in the Great Hall.
right. I mean, people all slept together, basically, in the same space. In fact, it's a wonderful moment when we discover that make a bed. It doesn't mean to put sheets and towels and the lovely linens on it. It literally meant make a bed.
Yeah, I mean, you know, originally you either rolled out a kind of cloth pallet or you just kind of heap straw and put a blanket down on top of it. And that was it. You sort of made a bed for yourself for the night. It was a much more fluid and informal arrangement than we are used to now.
Now, when the house was still a hall, it was warmed by an open hearth, which had some really distinct disadvantages. For instance, you write that it was like having a permanent bonfire in the middle of the living room.
Was essentially what it was. I mean, there were no chimneys up until about the 14th century. What you did was you had an open fire, and all the smoke just kind of leaked out a hole in the roof. And an open, you know, fire in the middle of a room radiates heat much better than a fireplace does. But it also meant that there was a lot of smoke and sparks and things drifting about.
When chimneys came into being and you got the hearth out of the middle of the room, what did that mean in terms of how people lived?
Well, it had one really, really huge revolutionary effect, which was that all this roof space that used to be taken up, filled with smoke and would have been unlivable, that was now comparatively clean. And so people could move up there. And it really meant that people could start thinking about building and upstairs. From that point, they started to discover the whole concept of privacy and having space of your own.
And then, language took this up. You describe the names of some of the rooms that were created. Tell us about some of the rooms.
All kinds of words. It was study and boudoir and cabinet and closet and all these other words all began to come into the language.
I like the one word you just mentioned, boudoir, which is usually connected and was then even to sort of sexual intrigue. But it actually translates into what?
It means a place to sulk.
To sulk.
French. Sulk, yes.
So those two go together, at least for the French.
Well, apparently. But it's certainly a place to, right from the very beginning, it was a place for the kind of mistress of the house to retreat to. And those private rooms upstairs were also where people now began to invite guests. So that what we now think of as a bedroom is a place that's dedicated to sleeping. They would use not only for sleeping, but also might be where you'd have a little dinner party.
All of these rooms, which were a little hard to keep warm, but they were also hard to keep lit for many centuries, really until the last 150 years, you have a chapter titled Fuse Box. Read for us the little section where you begin speaking of that.
Sure. We forget just how painfully dim the world was before electricity. A candle, a good candle, provides barely a hundredth of the illumination of a single 100-watt light bulb. Open your refrigerator door, and you summon forth more light than the total amount enjoyed by most households in the 18th century. The world at night, for much of history, was a very dark place indeed.
That is a stunning thing to hear, that up a refrigerator, there's more wattage there.
Yes, I know. Isn't it an amazing thought? And when I came across that fact when I was doing the research for the book, it was wintertime in England and completely dark. And I got one candle and went into one of the rooms of our house where there was absolutely no other illumination. I lit the candle and put it beside me and tried to read, picked up a book and tried to read by it. It's nearly impossible. I mean, everybody should try it as an experiment sometime, because not that long ago, a very large proportion of people, that was all the illumination they would have.
Give us an example of this, how people lived in the evening.
Can I read another passage too? Would that be all right? But there's a paragraph here that I think explains it a little bit. Occasionally we can see into the dimness, as it were, when we find descriptions of what was considered sumptuous, as when a guest at a Virginia plantation, Nominee Hall, marveled in his diary how luminous and splendid the dining room was during a banquet because 7 candles were burning, 4 on the table and 3 elsewhere in the room. To him, this was a blaze of light.
Let's go to the dining room, which didn't come into being until fairly recently, the late 1700s. Tell us about its origins.
Yeah, well, I mean, I never stopped to think about that. But you don't have dining rooms in your home because at some point in history, people suddenly decided they wanted a room dedicated to eating. What happened, rather, was that for a long time, there was no upholstered furniture. And when it finally began to happen that they could make all this stuff in the late 18th century, they were also finding that guests, when they were sitting in these chairs, were tending to wipe their fingers on the upholstered furniture. So the mistress of the household essentially decreed that it was necessary to put aside a particular room dedicated to the purpose of eating so that they weren't, you know, kind of spilling food and messing up the really good furniture in the living rooms.
Was there something that completely changed the way you looked at your own home? Things you would never think are connected.
The thing that I hadn't expected and that was the kind of main discovery for me in the book is that the house is just full of surprises, mostly because we don't stop to think about these things. Because it's part of our everyday life, we don't stop to ask, why do we have salt and pepper and not salt and cinnamon? And when they talk about things like room and board, what's the board? What are they talking about? And all these things that are just part of everyday life, there are reasons for why we have four tines on our forks and so on, because that's what history made them.
Bill Bryson's new book is At Home, A Short History of Private Life. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure, Renee. Thank you for having me.
And this is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montagne, back home again.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
In 1978, the phrase in vitro fertilization was something the experts said. The rest of the world spoke of test tube babies. Newspaper columnists and editorial writers invoked Aldous Huxley's image of baby hatcheries in his dystopian novel Brave New World. Jeffrey Kahn directs the Center for Bioethics at the University of Minnesota Medical School. And Jeffrey Kahn, have 4 million births through IVF trumped all the moral and ethical questions that were posed by this procedure?
I think at the outset there was such concern about the new and uncertain technology that this proposed that people were quite afraid. But 4 million births later, those early issues went away, but new ones certainly came in the aftermath.
As for the old issues, though, I mean, there were concerns of the potential eugenic consequences of IVF, that it wouldn't just help people who couldn't conceive, but it would help people who couldn't conceive with the kind of mate they would like to conceive. That, I guess, is part of life today.
Absolutely. And I think that the technology has evolved in ways that have brought some of those concerns to light. So we can now test embryos outside of the body and make decisions about which ones to implant based upon the results of those tests. And that's what people were fearful of in 1978. The technology just didn't exist until well into the 1990s.
You spoke, though, of concerns that weren't anticipated back in 1978 that have developed. What would you place in that category?
Well, I think things around new combinations of parents, effectively. So now we have the ability to combine sperm from one man, eggs from one woman. That resulting embryo can be implanted into a third woman, and then the child born from that pregnancy can be raised by a separate couple. So we have, in that case, 5 different people involved in the creation and eventual rearing of a single child. And that, I think, wasn't thought about in prospect quite in the way that it turned out to be a reality.
There is another area of concern, which is the notion that embryos that are not implanted are frozen, and whatever we do with them, are we doing that with human life, is disposing of them, disposing of human life. That problem persists.
Absolutely. And I think it's something that was foreseen in some respect, but the numbers at which we create and now store the excess embryos has really gotten to the point where we need a societal conversation and maybe a policy decision about what to do with those leftover embryos. The estimates are something like 1 million frozen embryos left in the United States alone, and we don't really have good plans for what ought to be done with them.
What about the ethical and moral issues for doctors? That is, should they facilitate multiple births for a woman who has no apparent means of support of sextuplets or octuplets? Or is it the doctor's job to honor the patient's wishes and let the chips fall where they may?
Well, it may be even a more fundamental conflict than that, in that we think about the right to have children as a basic fundamental liberty that we recognize. And so when an individual says, I'd like to have children, we don't usually ask why or how many or what techniques do you propose to use. And so we have the technology that allows us to create these high multiple birth pregnancies, bumping up against what we think of as a quite fundamental liberty. And we really haven't wrestled that to the ground either. And that's an issue that started in 1978 and certainly persists today.
There's another level of discussion of medicine, which is, what do we think are the normal needs of making people well that should be covered by insurance plans, public and private? Have we settled that one when it comes to fertility treatments and IVF? Do we understand what it is that every woman or every couple is entitled to?
No, absolutely not. And in fact, in the United States, there's quite a variety of coverage when it comes to reproductive medicine techniques. So some policies will cover a few cycles of in vitro fertilization for any one individual. Many policies don't cover it at all, viewing it not as a treatment of an illness or a disease, but something that is rather more optional than that. So it is far from being a settled issue when it comes to who pays and if they pay, for how much.
Jeffrey Kahn, thank you very much for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
So Jeffrey Kahn, who is director of the Center for Bioethics at the University of Minnesota Medical School.
There's a new translation of Madame Bovary, the classic novel by perhaps the most exacting French writer of the 19th century, Gustave Flaubert. This translation is by Lydia Davis, a novelist, short story writer, and winner of the 2003 French-American Foundation Prize for her translation of Marcel Proust's Swan's Way. Here's what our book critic Maureen Corrigan has to say about Davis's new translation of Madame Bovary.
How tickled Madame Bovary herself would be by the latest homage paid to her, a feature in the September issue of Playboy magazine. For the original desperate housewife, as she's been called, the knowledge that she's the object of the collective male gaze might have relieved some of the dismal boredom that characterized so much of Emma Bovary's provincial life. Of course, what the Playboy connoisseurs are surveying is not Madame Bovary's fine form, nor her much commented upon smooth bands of black hair or great dark eyes. No, what's resting attention away from the latest lineup of hydroponically enhanced models is an excerpt from Lydia Davis's new translation of Gustave Flaubert's masterpiece. The most scandalous novel of all time hisses a headline on Playboy's cover. It's cheering, isn't it? The way Playboy upholds the primacy of the erotic canon over the claims of postmodern challengers like, say, a sticky, icky, groupie memoir like The Last Living Slut. For a translator, even one as renowned as Lydia Davis, Flaubert, the great apostle of le mot juste, must surely be the Matterhorn of authors. As Davis says in the introduction to her translation, Flaubert created Madame Bovary through a process of ruthless pruning. Sometimes, he reported in letters to his mistress, a week's hard labor would result in one meticulous page. To be simple, wrote Flaubert, is no small matter. Repetitions of words, sounds, and even letters annoyed him, particularly so in this emotionally radical novel where so much depends on style alone. For what's really scandalous about Madame Bovary, besides the infidelity plot for which it was put on trial for obscenity when it was first serialized in 1856, is its absolute demolition of sentiment. Madame Bovary is the rather uneventful fictional biography of a shallow young woman. Her baby daughter doesn't interest her, her lovers are manipulative cads, and her husband Charles is the quintessential amiable bore. Flaubert writes that Charles' conversation was as flat as a sidewalk, and everyone's ideas walked along it in their ordinary clothes, without inspiring emotion or laughter or reverie. With a message and cast of characters this unsympathetic, Flaubert had to depend on his language to keep readers engaged and to elicit the responses he desired. Ironic laughter, scorn, and occasionally pity. Davis says Madame Bovary has been translated into English some 11 times, but despite the fact that Flaubert was Mr. Style, she maintains that many of those previous translators ignored his zest for linguistic precision, and that's what she's trying to restore in this new edition. I'm not qualified to judge the accuracy of her translation, but I'm grateful to Davis for luring me back to Madame Bovary and for giving us a version which strikes me as elegant and alive. Two things overwhelm me about the novel on this rereading. The first is just how unrelenting Flaubert is in his contempt for sentimentality. well over half a century before Hemingway, in A Farewell to Arms, gave us the cynical phrase of the 20th century, "Isn't it pretty to think so?" Flaubert was carpet-bombing the maudlin and the mawkish. When Madame Bovary's first lover leaves her after their initial formal meeting, he thinks to himself, "Poor little woman, that one's gasping for love like a carp for water on a kitchen table." The other marvel about Madame Bovary is just how current it is in its assessment of the dangers that can result from blurring the lines between reality and fantasy. By dramatizing the effects of fantasy on a susceptible mind, Flaubert counters the laxity of our own age, where reality TV reigns and it's considered unsophisticated to expect clear demarcations between autobiography and fiction. Madame Bovary is literally destroyed by reading. Over and over, we hear about how she tries to model her life on the romantic novels she devours. Flaubert writes, "Before her marriage, she had believed that what she was experiencing was love. But since the happiness that should have resulted from that love had not come, she thought she must have been mistaken. And Emma tried to find out just what was meant in life by the words bliss, passion, and intoxication, which had seemed so beautiful to her in books." The great achievement of Flaubert's novel, of his clear as a marble prose, presented to us anew in Davis's translation, is that at the same time we're scoffing at Emma Bovary's naivete, we're also feeling ourselves drawn deeply into her story, susceptible to the same powerful pull of fiction that is her undoing.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Lydia Davis's new translation of Madame Bovary. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org.